Hey, Avani Dias with you. Thanks for joining me on the Hack Podcast. How did you go at school? If the answer's not very well, then uni may not be the best choice for you. Later on the show, we're going to tell you what researchers have found are the best paths to make money later in life if you got a low ATAR. Plus,
Indonesia is one of the world's biggest polluters, and a lot of plastic waste ends up here in rivers and streams and also in the ocean.
We're going to go to Bali, strap in, to hear about the innovative ways our closest neighbours are dealing with this massive waste problem.
The news that Jeffrey Epstein died yesterday, apparently by suicide while in a federal jail cell, has left many people outraged.
Triple J.
So how could the most high-profile prisoner and billionaire in the US right now, who had recently attempted suicide, have the means to take his own life in jail? That's the question the world's been grappling with after the death of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. You probably heard about it. He was due to face trial for new charges of sexually abusing dozens of teenage girls going back years and years. And Epstein wasn't just mega rich. He also had heaps of high-profile connections, not to mention Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, and Prince Andrew. So let's cue the onslaught of conspiracy theories about whether he really committed suicide. Here's Joe Lauder, and just a warning, this story discusses allegations of child sex abuse.
At one time, Jeffrey Epstein wasn't just seen at many of the biggest parties in American high society. He organized and hosted them.
Jeffrey Epstein had developed a wide social circle in government, politics, science, academia, and fashion.
Jeffrey Epstein began working in the 80s at an investment bank before starting his own firm. The work was all about managing money for the mega rich. He was also rich. He had a seven-story, $80 million townhouse in Manhattan, a jet nicknamed the Lolita Express. We'll come back to that. A private island, you know, you get the idea. And his connections went right to the top. He was friends with Prince Andrew, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump. In 2002, Donald Trump said this to a magazine.
I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side.
There have been allegations of child sexual abuse going back years with Epstein. In the early 2000s, there was a long investigation involving at least 40 teenage girls. Their stories followed a similar pattern. They were recruited to perform massages at Epstein's mansion, which would end up involving sex acts, and they'd often be asked to strip and they'd be paid afterwards. One of the underage girls, Virginia Roberts, told her story to the Miami Herald.
The training started immediately. I mean, it was everything down to how to give a blowjob, how to be quiet, be subservient, give Jeffrey what he wants.
Virginia claims she was also flown to Epstein's private island for parties and given out to other high-profile men.
All you do is obey. That's it. And eventually it led to, well, now we're going to experiment and we're going to try you with another guy. It was all the same no matter where you went. All Jeffrey cared about was go find me more girls.
Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to two charges over procuring prostitution with a minor, but he dodged any major federal criminal charges in a plea deal. Instead, he served just 13 months in jail, and he could leave for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week for work.
He avoided federal criminal charges in 2008 in a widely criticized plea deal that is now under investigation by the Department of Justice.
After a major investigation into that controversial plea deal, Epstein was charged this year with sex trafficking of minors and faced up to 45 years in jail.
Breaking news this hour, officials say multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein has taken his own life.
Epstein's body was found unconscious by staff at a correctional center in Manhattan at 6:30 on Saturday morning. He'd been on suicide watch over a previous attempt and was meant to be checked in on every 30 minutes. There's going to be three inquiries into his death by the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Inspector General's office.
Attorney General Bill Barr appalled by the news, saying Mr. Epstein's death raises serious questions that must be answered. In addition to the FBI's investigation, I have consulted with the Inspector General.
I find it unbelievable, in fact, that they would ever take a man like this off of suicide watch.
Spencer Coovan is a Palm Beach attorney who represented clients against Epstein a decade ago, and he spoke to the ABC.
They are upset, obviously, that they were not able to have a full conclusion in a court of law here in the States and have him found guilty of what he did and the crimes he perpetrated. But there's also a sense of satisfaction that he'll never be able to do this again to any other young women. I've met the man, and he was a very vain individual. He always felt he was the smartest person in the room. He always felt as though he had one up on everyone. So one of two things happened here. He either decided he was going to go out on his own terms at the end of the day, and he was allowed to do so by a negligent jailing department, or alternatively, someone got to him.
What he's hinting at are the conspiracy theories all over the internet that someone orchestrated Epstein's death, even the Clintons or the Queen. And even Donald Trump retweeted one of these conspiracy theories.
President Trump has reacted to Epstein's death in what is sadly a very unsurprising way. He is spreading a conspiracy theory that the Clintons had Epstein killed.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting there, and if that story brought anything up for you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. I want to hear from you. Shoot me a text, 0439 757 555. What do you think about the Jeffrey Epstein case? Now, a couple of hours ago, lawyers for several women who say they were sexually abused by Jeffrey Epstein announced they're going to sue his estate for compensation. They were holding off suing up until now while a criminal trial was being pursued against Epstein. And we're getting heaps of texts on this. Someone says the president of the United States is a weirdo. Another person, what is disgusting is how complicit so many people were, turning a blind eye to the abuse. It was friends, family, security, pilots, housekeeping, the list goes on and on. And on Hack's Facebook page, Peter says, dead men can't talk, evidence destroyed. That's a really good point. Let's get into that. David Mack is the deputy director at BuzzFeed News in New York, and he used to actually be a Triple J newsreader, and he's been following this case really closely. Dave, thanks for joining us on Hack. So we just heard there are many conspiracy theories about Epstein's death. Is it really that suspicious?
The key takeaway for me here is that he was obviously a very controversial figure. His arrest was political right from the beginning because of who he was and who he knew. Obviously, he knew Bill Clinton in the past. He knew Donald Trump in the past. So there was always a political lens on all of this. And I think his death is no different. You've seen people on both sides of the aisle trying to spin conspiracy theories about this. And there's going to be two investigations into this. Obviously, there's been a massive failure by federal prison officials that has to be investigated and look at what exactly how this was allowed to happen. But until we get that information, I don't think it helps anyone to, try to put forward wild conspiracies of the like that we've seen the president here doing himself.
Usually conspiracy theories are isolated to people on Twitter who are just sort of on the fringes, but that's not the case with these Epstein rumors, isn't that right?
That's right. I've seen a lot of very prominent people, not just even the president. Joe Scarborough, who hosts a morning show on MSNBC over here, was on Twitter sort of trying to guess what was going on and planned ideas of who could have done this and, you know, who would have wanted him dead kind of thinking. Claire McCaskill, who's a former Democratic senator, plus also, Lou Dobbs, who is a Fox Business host, one of the president's closest associates.
Epstein was probably the most high-profile prisoner in jail at the time. We just heard that he was a high suicide risk as well. Shouldn't he have been more closely watched? Is that what people are questioning in America?
Absolutely. I think that's the main thing. I think people are stunned that this could be allowed to happen. Someone in a federal prison in one of the most secure prisons in the country here in the middle of Manhattan, and who had previously, we know from reporting just about 2 weeks ago, had some sort of incident where he'd tried to injure himself, had been placed under suicide watch. There's been reports in the last 24 hours that he was taken off suicide watch, and just some scattered reporting today on exactly whether or not checks were done. Obviously, they weren't done because he has killed himself.
The jail where Epstein was in Manhattan is so secure. El Chapo, the drug king, was in that building. How much pressure is there now on the Department of Justice to reveal exactly what happened?
You would imagine that they're going to release as much information as they can to the public about exactly what happened. you would expect that several people are probably going to lose their jobs over this. There may even be some sort of criminal investigation, depending on exactly what they find. But I think there's a huge public interest in this story, and it's not going to be enough to sweep anything under the rug.
We're chatting to Dave Mack. He's from BuzzFeed about Jeffrey Epstein's death. Dave, there are still dozens of alleged victims who still want justice, but the criminal case against Epstein has been dropped now because if someone dies in the US, that's how it works in the legal system over there. Will these women ever get their day in court now? Is there a way they can achieve any justice?
Well, there are people in his circle that might still be facing charges, and both who helped facilitate him and perhaps who were involved in any of this abuse as well. This was certainly the main media sort of narrative when he was arrested, which is who else, who's next? Obviously, he knew a lot of powerful and influential people, and there was a lot of chatter about who could be the next arrested. Obviously, we didn't see anyone arrested since his arrest, but we don't know what information the feds have gathered since his arrest. We don't know exactly what he told anyone. We know he pled guilty, but we don't know if he was speaking to investigators or anything like that. So it's certainly possible that they could still have some sort of day in court, but obviously now it won't be with Jeffrey Epstein on trial.
We know a lot of documents have now been unsealed relating to Jeffrey Epstein, and some really high-profile people have been named in those: Donald Trump, former US President Bill Clinton, and the Queen's son, Prince Andrew. Now, the latter two have said that they have had nothing to do with any of the crimes involved in this case. But what is next for the alleged victims?
What's next? The answer is I think most people want to know how this could be allowed to happen. And I think that's where the investigations are going to come to light. And then we'll see what evidence, if any, the investigators had to bring any possible charges against anyone else.
All right, Dave Mack, thanks for joining us on Hack.
Thank you, and sorry for my voice.
Hack
on Triple J.
That's David Mack from BuzzFeed in New York getting us up to speed on a really fascinating story. So many texts, Rob from Byron. Don't forget about the potential testimony Epstein might have given about those high-profile individuals. Another person, who cares how he died? One less sex offender. And a few conspiracy theories coming through on the text line. Someone says he was in a suicide-proof room with see-through walls under constant supervision. Yeah, that's not suspicious at all.
Industry insiders have been lobbying for years to get Australia recycling more of its own waste at home.
But at least one expert says it might be impossible.
On Triple J.
Plastic waste is a huge problem in Australia. We've been covering this issue heaps on Hack. But it's not just Australia that's working out how to deal with this problem. Our closest neighbour, Indonesia, has one of the worst rates of plastic pollution in the world. And its poorest residents are the ones copying the brunt of it. One NGO, though, is tackling this issue head on. It's a pretty cool project. It creates a machine which turns plastic waste into fuel that helps power remote villages. Our reporter Shalila Medora brings you this story from Bali.
When you think of Bali, you probably think of beaches and pool parties and Bintang. And while you're living the good life, you're probably contributing to a really big problem.
Indonesia is one of the world's biggest polluters, and a lot of plastic waste ends up here in rivers and streams and also in the ocean.
Indonesia is being a number two in the world for the plastic waste.
It's estimated that Indonesians use an average of 700 plastic bags every year, amounting to 187 million tonnes of waste. And that's something Alpha and his team at local NGO Get Plastic want to stop.
Okay, my name is Alpha Terrahman, and then my nickname is Alpha. And right now I'm as a coordinator of Bali for the Get Plastic.
He says most environmental charities simply collect up plastic waste and deposit it in landfill.
At the end, it ends up at one place at some field.
It's a landfill.
Yeah, the landfill. But Get Plastic try to solve what happened for the landfill, because mostly at the landfill, close from the landfill, is poor people living there. Also, mostly the landfill at Indonesia close to the ocean or to the river.
In other words, Alpha says what Indonesia is doing now isn't working, especially for the most vulnerable in society. Microplastics get into the soil and waterways
and can make people sick.
Where the plastic goes is mostly going to the small village.
Enter the Vespa. In 2016, Get Plastics founder Dimas Bagus Wijanarko drove a Vespa 120 kilometres from Jakarta to Bali. What makes this ride so special is that the Vespa ran entirely on fuel generated from plastic waste.
And then we just take the plastic waste from the street, we put it to the machine, and then result from the machine, we use gasoline at the Vespa.
Dimas has created a machine that converts plastic waste into fuel. It works like this.
The plastic we put into the reactor, and then we have a two reactor. For the first one, we make it melt. So the plastic will be melt, and then they steam it.
Once that's done, three different types of fuel pop out.
Diesel is the most, it's around 70%. Gasoline is 20%, and kerosene is 10%.
1 kilogram of plastic makes 1 liter of fuel.
With the machine, does it create any other kind of waste?
There is still the have a gas, but there is not toxic. And for the residue, we still have a residue, just like a charcoal. We make it for the painting.
These machines are now being used in two villages, one near Java and the other on Sulawesi Island. They're already having an impact.
Basically, the volume of plastic waste is already reduced.
One of those villages didn't even have power before Get Plastic came along. It now uses a donated generator to run the machine and gets fuel so it can be self-sufficient for years to come.
The machine is already with the stainless steel, so maybe you can use it more than 25 years for the next generation still can use it.
Turning waste into biofuel isn't exactly new technology, but existing machines require a lot of know-how to operate. Get Plastic has deliberately created a very basic version.
So the small village and then the landfill people, and anyone can build it and anyone can fix it if something happens.
You're probably thinking, this sounds super exy. Nope.
Maybe around $1,000.
Other organisations like the Worldwide Fund for Nature, or WWF, have already gotten on board and bought a couple of machines. Alpha is really hopeful that the machines will help stop plastic from polluting Indonesia's soil and waterways. But he doesn't want the machines to give people the idea that we can keep on consuming single-use plastics like we have been.
All of us can be more aware about the plastic waste and just use it wise. We're not anti-plastic, but we try to make people use it more wise.
Hack Triple J.
It's a pretty cool project. That was Shalala Madura with that story from Bali. Heaps of people commenting on Hack's Facebook page. Kaylee, you say, great, a new source of carbon emissions. Good point. But at the same time, it's still recycling the carbon rather than buying new carbon. Yeah, you're right, Kaylee. It is still good for the environment in that way. Dawn, you say, good idea. Hope it works. And Freddie says, now, why can't a business in Australia do this on a large scale? Surely the return on fuel would make this more viable than trying to sell recycled products. Well, someone who will know about that is Jenny Downs. She's from the Institute of Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. And Jenny's been researching how we deal with waste. Jenny, Australia only recycles around 12% of our plastics and the rest goes into landfill. What can we learn from the way this Indonesian NGO is dealing with its plastics problem?
Look, there are actually a large number of really exciting things that we can do with plastics. I mean, they're actually originally were oil, and there's lots of ways that we can turn them back into energy or fuel-based products. But all of these technologies are still at what we would call a demonstration phase, and it's working out how we can do it in ways that are cost-effective here in Australia. That's the real issue.
So is there any sort of national-scale project that's doing this kind of thing at all?
Oh, look, there'd be plenty of examples of it happening in small scale, individual businesses doing very cool things. But no, we haven't seen this sort of thing, I guess, all across Australia yet as a viable way of processing our plastics.
Indonesia, along with China and Malaysia, have banned developed countries like Australia from sending our contaminated waste there because of the problems that they're facing that we just heard about. Australian leaders have now committed to banning recyclable waste being exported overseas. Is that going to work?
Yeah, look, it's a really exciting move by the government to say basically that we need to process our waste onshore and that we need to have the mechanisms for dealing it here. And I think it's important to note that it's not that there's actually an issue with exporting our waste to countries that actually have a viable means of processing it and turning it back into our products, particularly when you consider that we import so many of our products from overseas. If we're sending some of the material back to be made into new products to buy them back, there's not really an issue with that. But there are some issues with the fact that we have been reliant on other countries to take our waste and we don't have the capacity onshore. So this ban will actually look to develop our own industry and create jobs here in Australia and hopefully exciting ways of reusing our waste to turn back into products that we can make use of here.
Is there anything actually wrong with exporting waste though?
No, look, it really you have to think about it. It's a trade. We have a material and other people want it and they literally purchase that material off our recycling companies.
So we're like making money off the exports.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a, particularly with China in historically, it's been a really lucrative market for a lot of our waste material because they have so much manufacturing, so many opportunities to turn that into new products. But the issues are where either we're reliant on other countries and their policies like bans then impact us, or more concerningly, where we're selling products to, I guess, kind of smaller businesses or even sometimes informal businesses in developing countries where the way that they go about processing that material is either bad for the environment or bad for health. And that's a concern.
Some researchers have said it might actually be impossible to completely stop exports from Australia. Last year, we sent 4.5 million tonnes of waste overseas. Is this an unrealistic idea, though?
I don't think it's actually necessary even to stop all exports. I know they're calling it a ban, and I think what that's doing is setting a vision, or like this is what we want in the future. We want to process material onshore. And I think if we actually develop the capacity to use our own waste here, we might find that there are still things that are particularly desirable overseas that we can't use here that people still want and that we can ensure is being used in a safe manner. There's no reason really to cut down to 0%. As I said, there's many good reasons for it, but it's just to make sure that we're doing what we can here, that we're creating jobs here for ourselves, and that when we are exporting, that we have a bit of that, I guess, view of what's happening to it and that we know that it's not causing problems overseas.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. We're chatting to Jenny Downs. She's from the Institute of Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. And we're talking about the government's moves to ban importing our waste overseas. Jenny, a lot of developed countries actually rely on this import of our waste to develop businesses locally, right? So how will they be dealing with the impact of a ban like this?
Yeah, it's true. So there's a lot of examples of, you know, entire villages, for example, that have set up to actually import waste, not just from Australia, but from many countries like the US, Japan, a lot of Europe, and to process that, to glean out the materials that are valuable and then to either use it or on-sell it to create money and livelihoods for themselves. And that's part of why I think that a ban 100% across the board is not necessarily a good idea. But Australia's fairly small, I guess, when you consider the volumes of waste that are coming out of other countries. So I don't think that even if we did ban everything, that we would have a major impact on those livelihoods.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, said that this is our own problem. We shouldn't be passing the buck. But do we have the infrastructure to actually deal with and process this waste sustainably onshore?
Not at the moment, particularly because we have been exporting a lot of our recycling over to China, but also because we've been losing a lot of our manufacturing industry. So as I said, a lot of the products and things that we use are actually made overseas and we import them here. So we've lost both the ability to process the material, but also to manufacture it into new products. So there's definitely going to be some investment needed in infrastructure to deal with this increased waste that we're going to keep here.
Jenny Downs, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Jenny Downs from the Institute of Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. A lot of text. We need to stop using plastic, period. Recycling it doesn't address the key problem, which is its creation from the get-go. Justin says, creating more jobs here by recycling our waste sounds like a great idea to me. And another person, a waste energy facility has been approved for Southeast Victoria and will use up all rubbish from area. It's on a huge scale. Well, we'll probably be seeing a few projects like that in the future.
Hack.
Australia will need up to 1 million more workers with TAFE qualifications.
On Triple J.
Did you do well at school? It seems like we're constantly told to go to university, and the figures show that's the way most young people go at the moment. But new research has found some young people would actually be better off learning a trade instead if they weren't that good at school and want to actually make money. If school wasn't your thing, did you go to uni anyway?
Or are you a tradie and raking in the sweet cash? Give me a call, 1300 055 36. Andrew Norden's from the Grattan Institute. He researches higher education and he's made these findings. Andrew, what paths should young people take if school wasn't their strong suit?
So I think if you're one of those mid-ATAR, say 50 to 70 students, if you're a guy, you're actually at quite high risk, if you go to university, of not getting a job that really uses your skills. And so you'll end up in a job that you probably could have got straight out of year 12, like a sales or service job. On the other hand, there are trade occupations in construction, engineering, maintenance, where you could actually earn a lot more than if you went down the university path.
What's the deal for women, though? Because we know that a lot of those trades are actually angled at men or male-dominated, things like plumbing, electrician, so on. But what about for women? What should they do?
So on our research, really the young women with lower ATARs who are going to uni probably making the right decision. So often they do things like nursing and teaching. And even though you won't get rich being a nurse or a teacher, there's good employment possibilities, pay is okay, and certainly better than sort of the childcare or elderly care jobs that they might do through vocational education.
Andrew, I don't like the sounds of this. Women need to make more money too, but it doesn't seem like that's the trajectory they can go on if they do a trade, isn't that right?
Yeah, the interesting thing that we found was that a few women do these trades and get the right qualifications for them, but a lot of them end up working in other fields anyway. And we think it's because these pretty male-dominated environments aren't particularly friendly places for women, not much part-time work, maternity leave not really encouraged. And so what we think is happening is that women are leaving for jobs that pay less but are more flexible.
Peter's called in. What was your experience? Did you do well at school?
No, I failed.
You failed?
Year 11 and, year 11 and 12 was just social for me.
Yeah, and did you end up going to uni? What did you decide when you finished school?
My dad pushed me through uni all the way through high school and I just wasn't for me. And yeah, once I got out of school, I kind of bummed around on the dole for a while. In the end, I got a job at the meatworks, and after a couple of years, I kept pushing them for an electrical trade and they finally caved in and gave it to me.
Yeah, and how are you doing now? Are you making lots of money?
Yeah, well, after the meatworks, I went to a sugar mill and did another trade, and now I'm out at the mines, and yeah, I'm
raking it in.
170 last year,
Congrats. Way more than me. Thanks for the call, Peter, on the Hack Facebook page. Mara, you say, I was the first person to go to uni out of my family and there's no way I'm earning more. I do, however, love my job, so that's a bonus. Jess says, we need to broaden our kids' eyes of what is available and ease the pressure put on them to attend university. It's not the be-all and end-all. And Hugh, you say heaps of people don't even like the course they do, but just do their degree to keep their parents happy. We're chatting to Andrew Norden from the Grattan Institute about what you should do after school if you haven't done heaps well. Now, Andrew, some of this is about degree choice as well, right? I did an arts degree, but I was constantly told I'd never get a job, and that's the same with science and commerce as well. Should young people just opt away from those kind of degrees?
Not necessarily if that's what they're passionate about. So, but these degrees are high risk. So you got a job that's probably using your skills, but a lot of people you went to uni with probably didn't. And so you have to take a risk in doing it. So the vocational jobs may not have the opportunity for high salaries, but they do have high rates of employment, and that's kind of that safety net approach.
And, you know, you've mentioned that young people still need to be interested in what they're doing, and, you know, if you're into performing arts, you shouldn't just opt for an accounting degree because, you know, you want to get a job at the end. So how should young people balance doing something they're interested in but also wanting actual employment at the end of that?
So I think they need better careers advice. So we should take their sort of their range of interests as a given, but then within that list, find the occupations which will satisfy their interests but still give them reasonable employment prospects.
And we're seeing a massive increase in uni enrolments but a decrease in trades. What needs to be done to fix that just quickly, Andrew?
Look, part of this is improved funding for vocational education. It is kind of the poor cousin of tertiary education, and a more equal funding system would help. But I think there needs to be cultural change as well so that parents actually support their kids when they want to do trades rather than pressuring them to go to university.
Yeah, is this a cultural shift needed or a policy shift?
I think it's both, but the policy won't work unless culture changes enough that people will do the courses.
Yeah, right. Andrew Norden from the Grattan Institute, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Heaps of texts on this. Someone says, why are we recommending caving into the system instead of trying to change it for the better? Another person, I've been to university, completed a science degree, didn't like my work choices. Now I'm a qualified carpenter, happy with both my choices. And another person, I did both, where I did an adult apprenticeship and became an electrician and then went to uni and got my master's in business and project.
Tack. Triple J.
Thanks heaps for joining me on the Hack Podcast. Don't forget, we're always in your Facebook and Instagram feeds updating you every day about the biggest news stories. I'll catch you later.